listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Amanda Knox says the new movie Stillwater is using her story without her permission and contributing to the false idea that she's guilty of a crime she's been exonerated of. Talk to a communication studies professor about ethics in filmmaking. Now, U.S. military leaders say they're bracing for more possible attacks from the Islamic State as they continue to withdraw from Afghanistan. Yesterday, a suicide bomber near Kabul airport killed more than 100 people, including 13 American service members. A regional offshoot of Islamic State claimed responsibility. Hours later, in a speech from the White House, President Biden said justice would be delivered.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this. We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
The U.S. is working to pull out of Afghanistan entirely by this Tuesday, marking an end to the 20-year U.S. deployment. Dalia Fahmy is an associate professor of political science at Long Island University at Brooklyn and author of the book The Rise and Fall of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Future of Political Islam. Dalia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What was your reaction to the tragic bombing yesterday?
It's horrible. However, it's not surprising. Earlier this week, we saw warnings coming from within the CIA that a bombing was imminent. And yesterday, there were repeated warnings from multiple sources throughout the world that there would be a bombing, probably yesterday. So as tragic as it is, it's not surprising. There are a couple of lessons to be learned here. ISIS-K, or this group fringe from ISIS, that K standing for Khorasan, the province that they come from, wanted to send two messages. The first one was that the United States, the most powerful military in the world, could not secure the airport. They couldn't secure the airport with the entire world watching. And so ISIS-K wanted to send a signal, not just to the United States that's withdrawing, but also to the Taliban, who are inheriting the state, who are now coming into power, that they are going to face this new dawn of an emboldened ISIS-K. ISIS-K has many defectors from the Taliban, those who actually saw that the Taliban striking a deal with the United States, having conversations and negotiations in Doha, in Qatar, were them turning their back on militancy and jihadism. And so ISIS-K is trying to send a message to the United States and to the Taliban that you couldn't secure this airport and you are here. And the second was that the U.S. made a deal with the Taliban. They did not make a deal with the ISIS. And they're trying to reassert their power. Now, if you recall, President Trump had been for years saying, we defeated ISIS. What they signaled was that they are not just gone, but they're emboldened inside of Afghanistan, that they were going to reclaim territory. What happened was for the past 2 years, they didn't have territory. Now they're attempting to reclaim territory. And so this withdrawal signifies a new dawn in Afghanistan, where it's not just the rise of the Taliban coming to power, but the Taliban having to deal with fringe groups from within them, like the Haqqani Network, the ISIS and ISIS-K, who want to undermine their power. And so we're going to see a very unstable Afghanistan. And what we do know about instability is that instability, as it did 20 years ago, does not remain in one region, but could have blowbacks around the world.
And we talked to you a few months back about your concerns about the Biden administration's plans for withdrawal. We talked to you a couple of years back about the Trump administration's negotiations and plans for a withdrawal. Both presidential candidates in 2020 in favor of withdrawal. Why were you concerned? Why did you want to see some U.S. military presence remain?
When we spoke 2 years ago, when the Trump administration was beginning to sign or beginning to negotiate and ultimately did sign a peace agreement with the Taliban, we spoke and I said, this will undermine the Afghan government. The Afghan government was not part of these negotiations. So imagine the United States is negotiating with the Taliban absent the Afghan government. Of course the government was going to collapse. And we spoke about how it would be undermined, and it was becoming undermined as of 2 years ago. Now, this is actually much worse than I think the average person realizes. The two founders of the Taliban were Mullah Omar and Mullah Bardar. Mullah Omar was killed by the United States a few years ago. Mullah Bardar's arrest was ordered by the head of the CIA to the Pakistani authorities to arrest him. CIA Director William Burns is the one who actually ordered his arrest. On Monday, CIA Director William Burns met face-to-face with Mullah Bardar, the founder of the Taliban, the founder who is now going to become the president of Afghanistan. And so, I'm sorry, the founder of Al-Qaeda, who is now going to become the president of Afghanistan. And so when the person, CIA Director Burns, who orders his arrest, meets with him on Monday, it signals not just that the Taliban is being recognized and coming into power, but they're actually part of the negotiation process. And so while I was very weary of what was happening 2 years ago, seeing Secretary Pompeo last fall meet with members of the Taliban to actually sign this, H.R. McMaster, President Trump's former national security advisor, said that when Secretary Pompeo met with them and signed this agreement, he essentially signed a surrender to the Taliban. And what's happening is that it was built to undermine essentially the government that the United States had been trying to put into power for the past 20 years. And so when, after 20 years and $3 trillion, the goal of the war was to defeat al-Qaeda and remove the Taliban from power, what we have today is the Taliban coming back into power and hearing from Pentagon officials that al-Qaeda was never defeated. And on top of that, we have an emboldened ISIS. The forces that were in Afghanistan were about 3,000. What does 3,000 mean when we have, for example, in Germany today still troops, and in South Korea and in different parts of the world we've been? These troops signal that the United States was still there and watchful. The removal of these troops signals that the United States is going to be absent. We will have not just a power vacuum, but the physical space that these two terrorist groups had been looking to reinstate, they now have it, the physical space. They had been rendered dormant in cyberspace. Now they actually can reclaim territory.
As we wrap up, Dahlia, there have been calls from Republicans and some Democrats saying, hold on, let's unwithdraw. Let's leave troops here. Is that a realistic option now that there's not a government that's going to be willing to accept those willingly?
No, because the agreement was based on complete withdrawal. Complete withdrawal on the 31st means that the United States would have to also withdraw the 5,000 troops that are there. The withdrawal of them has to begin tomorrow. And so we have no more time left. There's no more space for negotiation. The past couple of months since this agreement was signed have also been violent, even though no one's been paying attention to them. We're starting to see the Taliban emboldened, Al-Qaeda emboldened, and also the ISIS-K emboldened. And so what we could be actually seeing in this moment of retreat of U.S. power from the region is a level of uncertainty that could lead to the U.S. attempting to secure short-term security interests at the expense of long-term security interests.
Dahlia, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Dahlia Fahmy, Associate Professor of Political Science at Long Island University at Brooklyn, author of the book The Rise and Fall of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Future of Political Islam. We talked to her today about the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. More on that topic coming up Monday on Central Time. Now, earlier this week, the U.S. Supreme Court weighed in on immigration policy, confirming a lower court decision against the Biden administration. The ruling said the Biden administration was wrong in its attempt to end a Trump-era policy of forcing asylum seekers to remain in Mexico while their applications were being processed. The case is significant for immigration policy, and it's another sign of possible changes in the court with three appointments during the Trump administration. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about this Remain in Mexico policy coming back into effect? Big picture, what are you watching for from the U.S. Supreme Court with these three new appointees in the last 4 years? Call 800-642-1234. Rick Hsu is professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law with expertise in asylum and refugee law, federalism, and immigration law. Rick, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Let's start with this Remain in Mexico case. I gave a Cliff's Notes version of what happened there in the setup. Could you give us a little more information about what this means?
Yeah, essentially what it means is that we return back to the Trump-era policy, which was not around in the grand scheme of things for all that long. of sending individuals who are applying for asylum back to Mexico to await their turn in immigration proceedings. In the past, they've been allowed to remain in the United States awaiting those proceedings. And of course, the concern that has been raised is that there's been a lot of allegations and evidence showing that there's abuse of immigrants by criminal elements in Mexico when we send them back.
Can you give us a sense of the legal status of this now? Is this a completely done deal? Remain in Mexico is in effect until, I guess, Congress does something different, or are there more court angles to be wrangled here?
So this is interesting, right? So this is not a completely done deal. The issue has been decided by the lower court, but has not gone through the full appeals process. We're just really talking about the injunction that, you know, what is going to happen while the case is proceeding. And what the lower court decided is that they would cancel and not allow this policy to be rescinded. And the Supreme Court agreed, allowing that injunction to remain in place and refusing to stay it.
There have been a lot of questions about what the impact of Trump administration appointees on the Supreme Court were going to be, and looking at each individual decision, trying to read what it might mean for the future. On immigration law in particular, what do you see from this relatively new makeup of the court on this and related rulings?
Yeah, so it's not just the makeup of the court. It seems to be their response to the new presidential administration as well. Interesting enough, when there were a lot of challenges against Trump administration policies with regard to immigration, the Supreme Court actually overturned a lot of injunctions, essentially allowing those policies to go forward. And in fact, a lot of justices were concerned about injunctions being issued by lower courts, and again, disturbing the presidential discretion to set policy. This decision shows that they're not necessarily sticking to their principles when it comes to a new presidential administration. The justices that were concerned about nationwide injunctions didn't seem to be at all concerned with this one. And all the concerns that they have said about presidential administrations having the discretion as a policy didn't seem to keep them from essentially keeping this injunction in place. And it should be noted, this is not the only thing that the Biden administration is dealing with. Just in the past month alone, a Texas judge also struck down Biden's effort to prioritize certain deportations over others. And there's also another decision that came out just last month saying that DACA is unlawful. And those are all actually heading up to the Supreme Court to determine in some ways whether or not those injunctions would go into effect, although those judges stayed it for at least a few weeks. So we might see two other decisions from the Supreme Court very soon.
Staying with immigration-related issues in the courts, we're bringing in some refugees from Afghanistan under special immigrant visas, expected to be more people seeking refuge from the country during the Taliban takeover. Do you have thoughts on refugee law in particular?
Yeah, I think this is going to be another thorny issue, and it's going to return to some of the things that we saw following the end of the Vietnam War. So right now we're dealing with the special immigration visas, and that's going to be a big wave with the airlift. But even after that, we're probably going to deal with individuals who arrive into the United States seeking asylum, in part because of persecution and our sort of engagement in Afghanistan. And after that, we might even face individuals who are in persistent refugee camps, right? If they decide to flee Afghanistan and then are in those camps for many number of years, we may feel obligated to take them in as refugees. This is what happened after Vietnam. We had decades of essentially dealing with these immigration issues. Of course, the circumstances have changed a little bit. The Republicans were strongly in support of the Vietnamese refugee at that time. Republican administration feels different about immigration now, even with regard to this set, though they are divided. So this is going to be a persistent issue. And certainly the way we're seeing it now, we need a political solution. Relying on presidents and courts to deal with this seems to be highly problematic and is contributing to a lot of whiplash in our immigration policy.
We're talking to University of North Carolina law professor Rick Sue about immigration law and rulings from the U.S. Supreme Court and how the judiciary changed under President Trump. 3 appointments to the Supreme Court, and that's not all. What effects that's having now and possibly in the future? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Looking at various immigration policies, lots of presidential executive action, and then lots of court reaction. Do you think that's how we should be handling immigration policy, or do you want Congress to come up with some solutions? And big picture, what do you think of the impact of three U.S. Supreme Court appointments under the Trump administration? Are there issues you're watching for in the future that you think rulings might change the way things work in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Rick Sue, professor of law at the University of North Carolina, talking about a Supreme Court decision this week that effectively forces the Biden administration to reinstate a Trump-era policy of keeping asylum seekers in Mexico while their applications are being processed. We're also taking a broader look at the influence of former President Trump's Supreme Court appointments. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rick, people talk, I think, a lot about the influence of the court, the power of the court, how often it weighs in on big issues. But with an issue like immigration, where so much of it's being done by executive orders and Congress isn't doing anything, is that kind of inherently leaving openings where the court has to get involved because Congress isn't doing its job?
Yeah, it's interesting. It certainly is leaving the openings for the court to get involved. But in the past, the court has actually been, especially in immigration, quite reserved. Even the standards that the court applied in this particular case admittedly says that there should be substantial deference to the president to set policy, especially when it comes to immigration. And traditional immigration law is that the court should defer to political judgments because they are not in the political realm. So the fact that there is an opening, but the courts seem to be jumping right into it, is a little bit of a new development and seems to represent a shift in the activism, if you will, of the courts these days.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Stephen is with us in La Crosse. Stephen, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm harping on the stay in Mexico policy. I think it's an appalling policy. And I wondered, what's the justification? How is it consistent with either international asylum laws or the asylum laws that our country has agreed to in the past? Thank you for taking my call.
Stephen, thanks. Rick, go ahead.
Yeah, in fact, there is a strong argument. Even when the Trump administration first implemented it, and there was litigation, including a lower court that said that it was unlawful, essentially saying that is not only unlawful under a sort of domestic law, but domestic law in connection with our international obligations. Remember, these people are applying for refugee asylum status, so they're claiming that they are sort of seeking protection for persecution. And it is our obligation to not return someone into a situation in which they may be subject to harm. Though it seems to be that is what is happening right now. So that actually was one of the justifications that the Biden administration gave. And now the funny thing is, what the lower court held and the Supreme Court also seemed to have upheld as well, was that the decision to rescind this policy was arbitrary and capricious. Like I said, the court is not in a position to question the policy. It's only a problem if it's completely arbitrary and capricious. And interestingly enough, that's what the lower court found, satisfying that really high bar.
Stephen, thanks for that call. Go to Charlie in Door County now. Charlie, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm sorry. I'm just kind of jumping in on this. I jumped in the car to run to the grocery store, and it came up. And this is always something that intrigues me. Early on in the Trump administration, the Republican Party, as you know, controlled both the House of Representatives and the Senate, and, of course, had the White House. And had they the political will at the time to pass solid immigration reform, the Congress could have gotten it done. But I don't know if that was in their interest to do it, because immigration is one of those hot-button issues that rallies the base on both sides, and it's kind of a rallying point, and there just doesn't seem to be a will to fix it. Well, I have a question. When was the last time that we passed an immigration policy in this country?
Charlie, thanks for the call, and happy shopping. Rick, that question, it's been a while.
It has been a while. I would say the last comprehensive large-scale immigration reform was 1996. And of course, we had another one following 9/11, much smaller. And we've had a few amendments here and there, but we have not addressed this issue broadly. Think about the DACA issue, right? That has been persistent with regard to Dreamers for a very long time. And I think the caller's right. I mean, one of the reasons why DACA has not been addressed and is still hanging around is in some ways the Republican Party and a lot of people are actually quite divided on it. There is a strong anti-immigrant stance. On the other hand, Dreamers are very sympathetic and they poll really well. Though it's interesting that, you know, it seems like from polling, most Americans, for example, support some sort of pathway to citizenship for Dreamers, but Congress is not acting on it and has not acted on it. And I think what's going on now is it's all on the president and now increasingly on the courts. And this is actually a very dangerous way to set policy, I think, in this particular circumstance.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute or so, Rick, bigger picture, new look to the court. Everybody, I think, is reading individual issues to say, oh, yes, it's way more conservative. Oh, no, wait, they're surprising people some. What issues are you watching for in the next couple of years with this court?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are big topic issues with regard to Roe v. Wade, the Second Amendment. But I think the one thing that we should be paying attention to is the degree to which this court might be striking down statutes, not just presidential executive decisions. And I think what's interesting here is even when we had a conservative court before, you had institutionalists like Chief Justice Roberts that was sort of still trying to maintain a more deferential view, you know, sort of position of the court. But now that there's a 6-3 majority and they don't actually need Chief Justice Roberts, I think the court is much more emboldened to take really radical steps to limit congressional and legislative power in addition to presidential power. And I think that's what we should be looking for as well.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rick Sue, professor of law at the University of North Carolina School of Law. We talked to him today about changes in the landscape of the federal judiciary, the Supreme Court from the Trump administration, and their latest rulings on immigration issues. Coming up, streaming apps have given us more access to documentaries than ever, but should we consider them a kind of journalism? We'll talk to an expert about the ethics of documentaries and the gray areas that come up when real-life stories are told on a screen. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, scores of Afghans and at least 13 U.S. service members are dead after a suicide bombing near Kabul's airport. What does this mean for the U.S. withdrawal? That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the new movie Stillwater is getting Oscar buzz, but it's also causing controversy. Filmmakers have said the movie is inspired by the story of Amanda Knox, an American student who was exonerated on charges of murdering her classmate while studying abroad in Italy in 2007, after initially being convicted. Knox says the movie is using her story without her permission and contributing to the false idea that she was guilty. That's in a fictionalized movie, but questions are also coming up in a new wave of documentaries, questions about the ethics of storytelling when real people are involved. We're talking about some of those ethical issues in filmmaking, fictional, and documentaries. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What responsibilities, if any, do you think filmmakers have to real-life people they depict in their movies? Does it matter depending on who that real-world person is, an ordinary person, say, versus a big-name celebrity? Is it okay for films about real-world events to take creative liberties that might not have happened in real life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Patricia Ofterheide is a communication studies professor at American University. She has studied ethics in documentary filmmaking. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
What a pleasure. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, I want to start in the fictional but inspired by category here with a listen to Amanda Knox's criticisms in her own words. Here she is speaking on NPR's All Things Considered earlier this month.
My identity is, first of all, associated with a series of events that I had nothing to do with. So anytime I try to speak about my own experience as a wrongfully convicted person, I am constantly put up against the victimhood of Meredith Kircher, whose own victimhood has in a large way been erased.
What do you think of this this story about Stillwater? Filmmakers have mentioned Amanda Knox's name, but it's not really about her. And then we hear from Amanda Knox herself. What do you make of all this?
Well, I think I'm glad that Amanda Knox has been raising these issues because that story does involve her. And I think and there are clear repercussions for her life, as should be completely obvious. And she has been the victim of false narratives since the beginning of the ordeal that she went through. So clearly, anything that brings attention to her, and this episode in her life will naturally re-traumatize her. So then the question is, to what purpose? What is the public good that is served by doing that? Because you can imagine a situation where you do expose somebody, re-traumatize them, draw public attention to them again. It's a world of social media. She's going to get a lot of attention there. But for what purpose? And as far as I can tell, Stillwater is intended to be an entertaining mm-hmm. Crime drama. And I'm not understanding why she has what the ethical justification is for doing that to her.
Do you think, and sticking with fictional movies that depict or are related to real people, is there a different kind of ethical standard with a normal person, a non-famous person like Amanda Knox, versus a political figure, a celebrity, a rock star, you name it?
So I think I'm talking about ethics, and there's also law. Mm-hmm. And there are real differences between individuals, ordinary individuals, and celebrities in law. But I think we're just talking about whether it's decent, what's decent. Mm. And I think there are lots of reasons to examine the lives of public figures. I'm sure that when Henry Kissinger watched The Trials of Henry Kissinger, which is a documentary, that is not how Henry Kissinger would have ever told his story. It basically depicts Henry Kissinger as a war criminal. But the people who made that film also did a lot of research to make sure that what they were saying was not only not libelous, which would have got them in trouble, but also, not contestable. Their interpretation might be not what you or Henry Kissinger might have done, but they have a right to be able to interpret, because they think it is important in the public good to draw attention to the public behavior of a public man. So I do think it's different. It's different ethically as well as legally between somebody who was expecting the kind of privacy that comes from the anonymity of an ordinary life, the relative anonymity of an ordinary life. But I think there's always a moral and an ethical responsibility to say, why are we doing this? What is the trade-off for invading people's lives here and exposing everyone to our interpretation of them?
We're talking to Patricia Ofterheide, communications studies professor at American University, looking at ethics in documentaries, which we'll get to in just a moment, and in fictionalized movies that tell some or all of a real person's life. You can join in with your thoughts or questions on those subjects at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Patricia, this Amanda Knox story that's been in the news, one of the reasons we called you. The other one that got us interested was this documentary on the late Anthony Bourdain, chef, travel documentary guy himself. And here's this documentary, and it came out that some of the things we hear Anthony Bourdain saying in the documentary, he never said. They were things he was quoted as saying or emails he'd written and then electronically redone versions of his voice reading these sentences. And that's raising some eyebrows. Before we get into wider issues in documentaries, what do you think of that particular case?
I thought there were so many things that were fascinating about this, not least that AI is kind of the cutting edge of mm-hmm. deception. And you've probably also heard about this use of artificial intelligence in deep fakes. And some people might have seen that deep fake of Obama saying, "I didn't really say this," you know, which is a demonstration of how good AI can be in creating illusion. But clearly a lot of people, when that happened, when Morgan Neville says to the New Yorker critic who's interviewing him, and she says, "How did you get that email of this confidential email of his? How did you get audio of him talking?" And he says, "Oh, that was AI." And she's like, "What?" And he says, oh, there's more. There's more that you'll never find out about in the film." And she's like, "Well." And then he says, and she says, "Is that an issue for you?" And he says, "Listen, we can have a conversation. We can have a panel about it at some film festival afterwards, okay?" And that whole interaction was fascinating to me because clearly Morgan Neville, who's a very popular and very successful filmmaker, very well rewarded for making films that everybody loves. 20 Feet from Stardom was just a magnificent movie. Everybody should see it. So he doesn't care. He doesn't think anything bad is going to happen to him. He doesn't think it's in the least unusual or weird to be saying, "Well, you thought this was really, like, I was telling you real stuff about Anthony Bourdain, but I only made up the stuff I'm telling you about. I made up stuff I'll never tell you about." You know, and I'm fine with that. And so I really felt like this was a real marking moment because a lot of people came out on social media and said, "I'm not fine with it. I feel weird about that," which to me was an indication of what I had heard from filmmakers themselves when I did this big research project. And what they were saying was, "I want to be able to sleep with myself at night knowing that people wouldn't hate me once they found out how I made this movie. They wouldn't feel betrayed. They wouldn't feel like the rug had been pulled out from under them." And that's the feeling people got with this Anthony Bourdain stuff. They were like, "The rug just got pulled out from under me. I didn't think that was happening." So I think we've got this marking moment where the field is like, "We can do whatever we want to." And the audience is saying, "Actually, I have questions." And to me, that's exciting because that means that we're finally approaching a point in the field of documentary filmmaking that we could entertain the idea of something the field does not have, which is an ethics code.
And we'll pick up on that point in just a moment. Patricia Auchterheide is with us, communication studies professor at American University. She's with us today to talk about the ethics of movies about real people, both documentaries and fictionalized accounts or inspired by accounts. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When you watch a documentary, do you think of it as journalism? Do you think it's okay to fudge things a little bit to tell a bigger narrative, a bigger story, even if that means a bit of video that isn't necessarily what you thought it was, or audio in the case of the Anthony Bourdain story we were just hearing? Have you made documentaries or movies based on real life people yourself? What kind of decisions, questions did you face along the way? Call 800-642-1234. And do you watch lots of documentaries now? Because there's tons of them out there. Are you watching them and wondering what went into that? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@WPR.org. The conversation continues coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about ethics in filmmaking, documentaries and fiction inspired by real people. Patricia Auchterheide stays with us from American University. You can call in at 800-642-1234. Do you watch a lot of documentaries? There are a lot of them available on a streaming service near you. Do you wonder about some of the ethical decisions made about how reality is portrayed or skewed? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And Patricia, you mentioned your research. This is from 10 years ago or so, talking to lots of documentary filmmakers. And this idea, and I hadn't really thought about it, there is not like a consistent code of behavior, what you do, what you don't do among documentary filmmakers. And what you heard from is they're all kind of winging it seems like.
Well, I think what we discovered in our study was that people wanted to be able to behave in a certain way. But without a code and without standards in the field, they were really they were hostage to market forces. And those market forces have only gotten so much more accelerated with the streamers, Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and Peacock Plus and all of the streamers are looking to documentaries as relatively cheap ways to win reputation, awards, and audiences. Especially if you want to just get eyeballs, true crime is really the way to go. And there are so many fairly sleazy true crime series. Many people have watched Making a Murderer, which actually had the effect of creating a movement to demand the release of these two men who were accused of murder. And it's actually not clear that they didn't commit the murder. But the film is made in such a way as to really raise all your doubts about that in a way to completely make you side with them. And it's it created a very confusing situation in terms of real life while providing immensely entertaining true crime entertainment. And Reed Hastings, who's on Netflix, Reed Hastings, who runs Netflix, you ask him about, you run these documentaries that are about, you know, umpteen important issues. Do you have any obligation to make sure that there's any accuracy there? He says, no, I'm an entertainment company. If I were the New York Times, it would all be different. But no, I don't have any obligation. So that's the world that filmmakers themselves are operating in. And also filmmakers are often given no journalistic training. And they are usually working for divisions of companies that are entertainment divisions, not the journalism side. So they're often lacking some of the basic expectations. And here's the kicker. Documentary is only documentary because it makes this claim to be representing reality accurately in some way. Not necessarily with fidelity. Surveillance camera. It's a crafted piece of work, just like this show is, just like any article you ever read in a newspaper is. It's crafted and people have made decisions about what goes into it and what take they're going to make on it. So that doesn't get you away from the problem that it's documentary because you make a claim to reality. I would make the same argument about docudrama and about biopics, that you're making a claim to be representing reality there. And so you have some obligation to do that.
Let's go to our callers now. Tamarcus is with us in Eau Claire. Tamarcus, hi.
Hey, I just want to, real quick, I just started listening to you guys' podcast about 2 weeks ago, and I really enjoy it. Thanks. I just wanted to say I never really thought about the topic and the light you guys are putting it in, and just wanted to comment and question and say, when you do a biography on somebody as a writer, don't you have to go get the permission from the actor or actress, whoever it is that you're making a biography on, just like an artist would have to get permission from another artist to cover their song. So that's all I wanted to say.
Tamarcus, thanks for the call. Now, I know for writing biographies, there are sometimes authorized ones where you get full cooperation. You could write whatever you want, an unauthorized one without the cooperation. How much permission do documentary filmmakers get on whether and how to tell a particular person's story? The answer to that, from reading your older research, varies from maker to maker, right?
Well, there's also the law. If somebody's story is in the public domain, such as Amanda's was, you have no obligation to ask them anything. So ordinary people who had bad things happen to them often have their stories exploited, both for fiction and for nonfiction, and nobody needs to ask them anything or pay them anything legally. So that's why I was saying I was speaking from an ethical point of view. But from the viewpoint of celebrities, the reason why people get authorization and permission is to be able to get access to material they wouldn't be able to get on the public record, and to get prior permission to use some of the material that made that celebrity famous, for instance, a lot of their songs. We do have the right under fair use in copyright as creators of any kind to reference popular culture, to if you're playing a whole song, as the gentleman just suggested, if you're doing a cover of somebody else's song, you have to pay them for the right to sing that song. If you're taking a small clip of that song to make a point in a documentary or in a podcast or on a radio show, no, you don't need to pay them because you are reusing it in a way that's different. But in terms of getting permission from people, often filmmakers are working with somebody for a year at a time. And they will have signed a release at the beginning saying, I let you use my material. And they don't actually have any idea what they're getting into. They just, and neither does the filmmaker. The filmmaker doesn't know how big or small this piece will end up being. And so often people get into situations where they are now involved in this relationship for years, and how it works out really depends on the personal relationships. So and that's where ethics comes in more than law. It's like, how do you want to behave to this person when you tell their story to the world? What's going to happen if they think they were exploited? That's I think, what the most driving question is for most documentary filmmakers.
To Marcus, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Patricia, I want to stay with that point because I thought it was one of the most interesting things about your research. Different conditions, different filmmakers might say, you know what, this is something, a kid was seen doing something in my documentary that could haunt them for life. Maybe I owe it to them to take it out. Maybe I should talk to their family about it. In other cases, no conversation at all. Can you talk about some of the different opinions you heard on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I feel like when it's quote important people, when it's celebrities, filmmakers spend a lot of time saying, well, do we really want to talk about that? I mean, what's his name from the Rolling Stones just died? The
Charlie
drummer.
Watts. Yep.
Thank you, Charlie Watts. Okay, so Charlie Watts started having a relationship with his second wife when she was 13 years old. That, as far as I can tell, is you know, molesting a child. And that created some news that has created a whole undercurrent of comment. You did not see that in Charlie Watts' biography, his obits. So when it's important people, quote unquote, then we pay a lot of attention to how discreet we're going to be about some things that they've done. And I really believe, I think that filmmakers believe that if they could do it, they should give that same consideration to the people who are in their storytelling care, so to speak. That the question that was asked about that one incident where the kid had done something for which he was arrested was, is the arrest and the criminal incident germane, relevant, and central to the story I'm telling? If it is, it probably has to go in if I have permission of the family, but because he's a minor. but if it isn't, why am I doing that to him? Because it's going to haunt him forever. This will be public forever. So that I thought was very good, and a good example of ethical thinking, where the difference is really, what's the trade-off between the public good and the concerns, the legitimate concerns of the person I'm telling the story about.
And Patricia, just in our last few moments, are you hoping to see somebody, documentary makers or whoever, get together and establish solid codes? Just in our last half a minute or so.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that is, I think we're seeing a coalescing of interest, not only on the part of audiences, like the people who were outraged about the Anthony Bourdain documentary, but also on the part of filmmakers. Filmmakers have been organizing in these little subgroups, like disabled filmmakers and Asian filmmakers and producers. And there's a BIPOC group of filmmakers, and they've been working on these statements and manifestos and community letters that start to lay out some rules of the road. And I think that that leaves the door open for what I think is really the next step, which is for a membership organization to be able to take action to establish some kind of commonly shared values by which we make our ethical reasoning. And I really hope that happens.
Thanks a lot for joining us today, Patricia.
Thank you.
That's Patricia Alfterheide, Communication Studies Professor at American University, with us today to talk about ethics in filmmaking. A quick bit of research. Not Charlie Watts, but Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones apparently had that relationship with an underage girl, just to clarify. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Monday at 8, a new police training called Active Bystandership aims to help officers help their colleagues and intervene to prevent mistakes or de-escalate conflict. Find out how it works and hear from Wisconsin Police Department Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then it can be tough to try to learn something new, but our guest says we should never give up trying. We'll learn about the benefits of being a beginner. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.
Wisconsin Public Radio delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and music that inspires to hundreds of thousands of listeners, but not without the generous support of our donors. Consider WPR when you plan your philanthropic giving. Your gift makes a difference in our communities every day. Visit WPR.org/donate. Thank you.
As the highly infectious Delta variant of COVID-19 spreads, the Wisconsin Department of Health Services reminds us that getting vaccinated is the most effective way to protect yourself, your family, and your community from the serious effects of the disease. The vast majority of new COVID cases in Wisconsin occur among people who are not fully vaccinated. Learn more about getting vaccinated at dhs.wi.gov.